Okay, it's me sitting here. Oh, there we go. All right. Because nothing happens until the music starts. That's the way this thing goes. Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood, and this is Make Me Smart.
It is the show where we are smart about tech and the economy and culture, because none of us is as smart as all of us.
And the fun thing about our show is how we get to do shows about pretty much anything, and therefore we are able to hop directly from a conversation about socialism and its role in the 2020 presidential campaign, the Oscars, to today's topic, quantum computing.
Yay!
Boom! There are so many things to get smart about, you guys.
Yes.
I'm going to guess that a fair number of you don't know what I'm talking about when I say quantum computing. I'm going to guess I might be one of those people.
My hand is up.
Yeah.
My hand is up.
Kai, is this true that you just were like, don't tell me anything?
Yes. Yes. No, this is one of those where I should go in cold and then have you and our expert of choice, who we will introduce momentarily, literally make me smart.
He is the stand-in for the audience. Yes, I do. So Kai's going to be our stand-in for the audience today as we attempt to learn about quantum computing, which our expert is going to correct me if I get any of this wrong. But essentially, a branch of physics and development in computing that will allow computers to operate by this totally different set of rules. Hmm. So forget about sort of the binary, linear ones and zeros processing that we all know so much about in existing computer code. There's this metaphor that's been going around, which is that if you imagine a coin and you flip it, it comes up heads or tails,
yeah,
right? So that would be binary. It's either one or the other.
Gotcha.
But if you spin the coin, then while it's spinning, it is both heads and tails.
It's like Schrodinger's coin. Sorry.
And that this is sort of a metaphor for how quantum computing operates, that I guess all of these states are present at the same time. What it ultimately means, and we're not going to hopefully we're not going to geek out too much on how it exactly works. What we really want to get to are the implications of incredibly complicated data that can be processed in fractions of the time that it takes modern day computers.
All right. All right.
Kai, you're making noises.
Well, no, I want to climb right into this thing because I have so very many questions.
Okay.
So can we climb right in?
Do it.
We're going to get to Steven Weber. He is, oh my goodness, the computer guy. He teaches and studies at Berkeley at the School of Information there, and we got him on the phone. Steven, how are you?
I'm good. Good to be here.
So look, I'm going to start and then all y'all climb in. It goes like this. I just want to back up to something Molly said because we're not going to talk about how it works. I want to actually know, so quantum physics and quantum chemistry and all that stuff, right? That's like 18th level stuff. And you have to apply that to something that sits on my desktop because that's what I think of.
Kai, I don't think you're going to have a quantum computer sitting on your desktop anytime soon.
Well, then I'm out.
I'm really unfortunate to say. And, you know, the funny thing is you don't need one either. But you know what you could have on your desktop that would be useful?
What?
Go to your bookshelf.
Yeah.
There's a book there that you never read. Remember Brief History of Time by Stephen Hawking?
Oh,
I know you have it.
I do have it, and I read it, so...
See?
Come on.
You read the whole thing?
I did read the whole thing. I loved it. It was awesome. That was in my young and inquisitive phase. But anyway.
It's one of these books that everybody has on their bookshelf. Nobody reads past the page 5 because it's too hard to understand.
Yeah.
But you know what? Now you have to read it because this stuff is getting real. It's sort of like the way artificial intelligence and machine learning was like 5 years ago, and you wish you had learned more about it then, right? So that's why we should be talking about quantum computing today.
All right. So look, I hear that, and I have it. I take that on board. But really, I need you to... at the outset, front loaded with why I have to care about this now. What is quantum computing going to do for me as I'm, you know, some schmuck going to work, you know, 9 to 5 or 7 to 4 or whatever it is hours that I work? What difference is it going to make to me?
Think about it the way your life changed when you moved. Remember how you used to use an abacus when you were in high school or something?
or slide rule, maybe.
Nailed it.
Yeah, slide rule. Good.
Nailed it.
Perfect. So you used to use a slide rule and now you use an iPhone. Did it change your life? Yeah, change.
Yes, but not necessarily for the better. I will point out. Just let me interject a parenthetical dark place. Point there.
Same. We can talk about that another time. I mean, I can't quite imagine social media on a slide rule, but if you think about the kind of jump of capabilities that went from the abacus to the iPhone, then you're talking about that kind of order of magnitude change when you're moving from conventional computing to quantum computing. Now, let's be clear. there's a lot of things that people talk about quantum computing might be able to do that we actually don't know yet, because nobody has actually built a large enough working quantum computer. But think fast, like really fast, like orders of magnitude faster than what we can do today. So the classic example that people talk about is the ability to decrypt encrypted messages. It's really, really hard to do on a conventional computer. So hard that it would take like the rest of history to decrypt a message that's got a decent, like a long enough key.
Right.
Quantum computing probably could do it really fast.
Okay, so, all right, look, it actually turns out I have a whole bunch of questions, and I'm going to actually write down that first one there I have about quantum computing, but, I mean, about encryption. But back me up for a minute and give me the working person's version of how it works. What's the difference between quantum computing and
how close, how close is the coin thing?
Yeah.
The coin thing is actually pretty close. So in a regular computer, you have lots of switches. They're either on or off, a one or a zero, right? In a quantum computer, you have far smaller number of switches, maybe 8, maybe 16 today if you're lucky. And they're in all those states at once. It's like a continuum of the head and the tails and everything in between. And if you can read that in a probabilistic fashion, like sort of know where that thing is at a given moment and read off it, then essentially you're able to encode and compute just orders of magnitude more information at the same time. And that's like, it's counterintuitive in that regard, because it's just hard to kind of grasp what that would look and feel like. But if you can think about like the infinite number of states that that coin can be in, and you can read that information off it, that's what you're doing.
Well, I feel like part of what makes it interesting in the kind of quantum way is that in order to create these computers, you have to maintain those states, right? And then it has to be at like the one of the coldest places in the universe. And like that's what makes it so hard, is it's a very unstable physics situation.
Yeah. So think of it as like you have to make the hardware actually work. And that's an engineering problem. It's no longer like a basic science problem, but it's not trivial. And like everything has to go right. So Molly, you were at CES, right?
Yeah. Yep. And I saw the IBM Darth Vader.
Wait. For the layperson in this conversation, what?
So IBM brings to CES what it calls a kind of demonstration quantum computer. I think it's called the Q System 1 or something like this.
Yeah.
But it was a mock-up. And I understand that it was beautifully encased in like kind of the glass thing that would make Steve Jobs really proud. but it wasn't the working quantum computer, because a working quantum computer has to be at like essentially 0 degrees Kelvin, the coldest place in the universe. And that's pretty hard to do. The issue is the qubits, the equivalent of bits in a computer, they will decohere if there's any disturbance at all. Somebody dropping a pin on the floor two blocks away, any temperature above, you know, absolute zero. So it has to be completely, completely isolated from the normal world in order to be able to do what it needs to do. And then it still doesn't work sometimes.
So we're still talking about fantasy land a little bit, right?
Well, it's been demonstrated.
It's been demonstrated, right? But
yeah,
but we can get things to absolute zero, but we can't, you know, it's not an immediate real object, right?
Well, there are some projects. There's one at Google. There's one at Microsoft. There's one at IBM, of course. And they've got 6, 8, sometimes up to 16 qubits working for periods of time. The issue is, like in a regular computer, errors get introduced as the machine runs. And in a quantum computer, lots and lots and lots of errors get introduced because these tiny little perturbations. So the real challenge is it going to actually take more computing power to correct the errors that get introduced than the machine will actually have itself? Nobody really knows yet how high this can go.
Okay, so let me back you up for a minute to that thing that either you or Molly said a minute ago, which is basically to make a supercomputer work, everything has to go right, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Here's my corollary. Once we get quantum computing going, what could possibly go wrong? Right? Because I mean, come on,
let's get to
the encryption thing. This thing, these quantum computers, can break encryption that is in theory right now uncrackable, then every possible aspect of security goes away. Forget my bank account. Think about the nuclear codes.
Yes. Yes.
Is nobody taken aback by this?
Many people are taken aback by it. I mean, to the point where actually for a few years now, the NSA, NIST, and other kind of three-letter agencies have been figuring out what they call quantum-resistant encryption or quantum-proof encryption. So it is possible to encrypt data in a way that a quantum computer wouldn't be able to decrypt. The problem is, like, you've got this huge installed base of current RSA-style encryption, and turning that whole installed base over to replace it with quantum-proof, it would be the equivalent of, like, turning over the world's entire fleet of gasoline-powered cars into electric cars. I mean, you can do it, but it's going to take years, decades, and it's going to be super expensive. Yeah. So there's going to be this period of time where people can break encryption, and not everybody will know who those people are, and not everybody will have access to quantum-proof encryption. So think about what all the things you just said. Now think about that from the perspective of a drug cartel, or think about it from the perspective of a foreign government.
This seems like one of those things that's just because you can do it doesn't mean you oughta.
Except that you're going to have to.
Because why?
Like, right?
Because why?
Well, because everybody else is doing it.
Yeah, you probably heard that we're in a bit of a race with the Chinese around some of these issues. People talk about machine, but the Chinese have already demonstrated the ability to do quantum communication from a satellite down to a base station on Earth. And the cool thing about that is, if you're doing that kind of quantum communication, nobody can tap into it. Any perturbation, anybody who sort of listens in, essentially decoheres the quantum stream so that you would know if someone was tapped into that. That line of communication. So the Chinese are doing it. We're doing it. Lots of other people are going to do it too. You don't want to fall behind. It's that kind of a dynamic.
Wait, have we accomplished that satellite communication, thing, the quantum satellite communication specifically?
Not.
Or do we not
in
know?
In the public domain. Not that I know of.
They're not
that I know of.
Yeah. I mean, this is, we should say here, this is one of the rare areas where the president signed an initiative around this, the National Quantum Initiative Act, that actually calls for money, right? It's not just a private, a public-private partnership. It is a $1.2 billion investment in quantum information science.
Yeah, well, you know, $1.2 billion starts to feel like real money, but the Chinese have put, some people think, $3 to $5 to $7 billion into it in the last couple of years. So, again, it's a competition. Even the EU is putting money behind quantum science. I mean, everybody's sort of jumping on the bandwagon now as it becomes pretty clear to people that, you know, it's not science fiction and it's probably not a decade away. It's probably 3 or 4 years away. So we're racing to catch up.
So what happens if, forget the American government, the Chinese government, or the Europeans, what happens if, like, Google figures this out? Or, heaven forfend, Mark Zuckerberg?
Heaven forfend.
Right?
Indeed.
Can you imagine Zuckerberg with quantum computing?
I'm just saying.
Woo!
I can sort of imagine it, but I'm not sure that I want to. So here's the thing. I think we've all become accustomed, particularly, you know, living up here in the Bay Area, you've become accustomed to the idea that these technologies get developed in the private sector, they belong to the private sector, they belong to consumers, and then somehow they get spun off into military applications. This could turn that upside down. I'm not saying it will, but I'm saying it could, in the sense that this kind of technology would give such advantage to a government that had it when other governments didn't, that I just wonder whether or not it's going to end up at some stage a little bit more like the atomic bomb, where governments decided they didn't want that technology floating out there in the private sector for individuals to use or for companies to develop on their own. Now, I know there's going to be a bunch of people who are going to say, that's insane. There's no way that this technology could be renationalized. But, you know, I wouldn't bet 100% sure on that. I mean, if you had enough money and you had enough laws and enough regulation, you could probably bring that technology back inside the Pentagon.
Wow. So, like, if the corollary is the conversations that we're having about 5G, where we keep hearing these noises vaguely connected to the Trump administration that they might want to nationalize a 5G network because it is, in fact, considered so imperative economically and in terms of security, that idea goes to 11 when quantum computing is involved?
Yeah, it could. I mean, think of it as, like, you know, you have a baseline infrastructure, and if you control that quantum computing infrastructure, remember I said you're not going to have one of these things on your desk. Mm-hmm. You might be able to access it over the internet, quantum as a service, if you want to call it that.
Yeah.
But the service provider gets to decide what the user can do and what the user can't do. So let's say I'm a drug company, and I want to use some of this quantum computing capacity to do something that drug companies really, really want to do, which is to figure out how it is that proteins fold into a three-dimensional shape. Because that would be just great for drug development. So you might be able to access the quantum capability to do that. But if you tried to, like, late at night kind of get in there and decide you're going to use it to decrypt the email messages from your competitor to Moscow or something like that, maybe not so much.
All right. So let me cross the streams here for a minute on something else Molly and I have talked about, right? This is the quantum analogy of net neutrality, right?
Right? Guess.
Information wants to be free, man. Right?
Oh.
The internet's there. We got to let all the information go on the internet. But oh, no, wait.
Yeah.
Quantum stuff? No, 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 no.
Oh,
you can't use it for that. You can use it for the other thing.
Like, will there essentially be throttling? Like, the full power of the Q cloud, let's say. We should trademark that right now,
I'm
by the way. The Q cloud.
Right here. That's all I'm saying.
The full power of the Q cloud perhaps should not be available to the normals.
Well, you know, I don't see it so much as an ideological thing. It's just the way governments deal with these kinds of capabilities that could really change the game for militaries. Right. Like, you know, you have a quantum computer. You know those submarines that are on the ocean floor? Kai, I think you flew planes, not submarines,
right?
Yeah,
I was not a submarine guy, no.
Okay, so imagine yourself as a submarine guy.
Okay, first of all, no, but go ahead.
You think you're undetectable. And you're undetectable because there's no signal coming up from that submarine that a normal sonar can actually measure. But a quantum metrology system, if you want to use that word, which is fancy for measurement, can measure really small disturbances in the gravitational field of the Earth. So if the U.S. has a quantum computer and it wants to look for a Russian submarine, say, that you can't find with sonar, could you find them with quantum? Maybe you could.
Fundamentally, we're all walking around naked if quantum computing takes off. Metaphorically, right? There are no secrets.
Well, you know, look, I live in Berkeley, so I feel like we're all walking around naked anyway. But
that's a whole different show, man.
Yes. And here's the interesting thing. I want you to imagine this. So I have to believe that there are government agencies that have lots and lots and lots of stored up data from the last 20 years that they've been kind of just putting on a hard drive somewhere. Oh, yeah. All of Vladimir Putin's emails and his texts and all that kind of thing.
It's all in the warehouse from
And guess
Raiders,
what? They're encrypted. But what if you could decrypt them today?
Right.
Go backwards in time and decrypt all that stuff that was sent 20 years ago. It'd be kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. Write some pretty good books about that.
Yep.
Well, then I would imagine, too, that just as even in artificial intelligence and machine learning, that, you know, one of the biggest problems is the sheer volume of data. And that could even apply to things like climate modeling. Like, so many secrets, but then also so many sort of scary predictions feel like they could be made by computers. I mean, it just is, it's hard to, like, once you start going down the rabbit hole of potential change, it's hard to, like, stop.
Yeah, and look, I mean, we're in the middle of trying to figure out what we can do with machine learning and conventional computers. And, we're running into some limits in terms of, you know, the size of the data sets and the billions of experiments you can run on them. It's likely, nobody really knows yet, okay, but it's likely that all of that would accelerate substantially if you could do it in a quantum architecture. Not certain, because it may be that actually quantum turns out to be not so good for that kind of a problem. But, you know, if you think about the kind of slowing or gradually sort of roadblocks that are people running into with machine learning, maybe quantum is the key that unlocks the next generation of machine learning and artificial intelligence. Maybe it's the thing that finally creates artificial generalized intelligence where, you know, the computer wakes up and gets your joke.
Or it's the end of days.
Or it's the end of days. Could
Kai always goes to end of days. Speaking of the end of days, I have a question about power and electricity. And this is sort of a listener question because we did a story a couple of weeks ago on Marketplace Tech about data centers. And the electricity consumption of data centers and the sheer size of them. And someone said, oh, well, once we move to quantum, you know, a data center will be like a 4x4 cube. And then we were sort of riffing about, well, yeah, but that 4x4 cube has to be kept at 460 degrees below zero. Like what, what starts to be the energy implication there? Do we have any idea yet?
You know, It's a really good question, and I honestly don't know. I feel like, you know, we got simpler problems with, like, cryptocurrency mining burnt off as much energy as the entire, like, renewables sector in the world last year. So maybe, you know, we ought to tackle some of those problems first before we worry about quantum computing and energy consumption. But the data centers—
Okay, fine. Look,
you keep them pretty cool if you keep them in places like Iceland and Greenland. But, you know, it's really, really cold in the heart of a quantum computer. And that means liquid helium. And liquid helium is expensive and rare and all that kind of stuff. So, like I said, you know, everything has to go right. It's not a simple problem. It's an engineering challenge. But, like, on an order of magnitude, maybe more complicated than people who were heading up to Los Alamos in 1943.
Steve Weber is the faculty director for the Berkeley Center for Long-Term Cybersecurity at Berkeley School of Information. Steve, that is an awesome title. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks, Steve. Appreciate it. So listen, send us your thoughts about quantum computing and frankly, whether you're terrified or not, just, you know, not to prejudge your answers. I'm just saying. Make me smart at marketplace.org is where you can send them. Make it a voicemail. We'll get you on the podcast.
Yeah, and we'll try to put up a picture of IBM's demo device that they rolled out, which really looked a lot like the Batcave. So it does not do much to reduce that sort of that scary vibe. Be sure to check out our, if you have an Echo device in the house, maybe just hit mute real quick. Okay, our Alexa smart speaker skill.
That's public service journalism right there.
That's public service. There was a pause and everything. This Make Me Smart episode actually on quantum computing was inspired by an explainer that we did on Alexa, in part mainly the coin analogy there. All you do is say, Alexa, make me smart, and you can hear all kinds of short explainers on this and other topics from Kai and me.
This week we've got electric car history, diversity, and also digital undertakers. That one must have been you, Molly, because I didn't do that one, and I'm oh so curious.
It's a good one. It's fascinating.
All you have to do is say, Alexa, make me smart, and then you're in. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Boom. There we go. We're back. Just, you know.
Thump. That sounded so boom, cool. Boom, boom, boom.
We're back. We're doing our thing. I got two things which are fundamentally the same thing. Oh, look, you just put them in. Oh my God, I can't even believe you.
No, I put them in a long time ago.
You did not.
What are you talking about?
That was definitely before the show started. Your pants are on fire. Your pants are on fire. Oh my God, Molly.
All of you who watch, by the way, this video episode on YouTube will be able to determine for yourselves whether, in fact, my pants are on fire.
Yeah, you're lying.
Did you guys know we're doing that? I'm changing the subject, but I'm also promoting our new video episodes on YouTube.
Are you filming you on that end? Do we have the GoPro thing going for you? All right, good.
No, I'm rolling, yeah.
Good. All right.
I got my fancy 1080p webcam.
There you go. It looks great. It looks really, really good. So we're just going to get
you guys should watch it.
Enough of these freaking cannons and
Marketplace Sony's, APM.
Man. We're just doing a big thing. Okay, you want to go first? You liar, liar?
No, you should go because this is really interesting, actually. I saw you tweeting about it.
I'm going to go. So I have been saying every time the president has – let me get to macroeconomics and policy for a minute here. We are in a trade war with China, as you know. And part of that trade war, the larger part of it, is that we have imposed tariffs on many of our trading partners, but also some of our trading adversaries. And those countries include China and Mexico and Europe. And Canada. And the president is very fond of saying on Twitter and in his speeches that we are collecting billions and billions of dollars from the Chinese because of his tariffs. And I, because honestly, I can't help myself. Truly, I can't. It makes me bananas. Every time the president says that, I feel obliged to go on Twitter and say, China is not paying the tariffs. American consumers are paying the tariffs. And I've been saying it for a very long time now. And and frankly, I've been feeling a little lonely because he keeps saying it and I keep having to say the other thing. Anyway, there were two economic papers out this weekend basically saying the same thing. And I will read from the abstract from one of them. It's from Princeton and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and also a guy at Columbia. And here is the relevant part of the abstract. Overall, using standard economic methods, we find that the full incidence of the tariff falls on domestic consumers, with a reduction in U.S. real income of $1.4 billion per month by the end of 2018. End of quote. Number one, told you so. Number two, $1.4 billion a month is not a huge amount of money, right? It's like $17 billion a year, but it is not winning a trade war, which is what we were told trade wars were. And, well, and that's what I got.
Yeah. I just, reduction in U.S. real income.
Right.
Yes.
Right. So totally. American consumers are paying the tariffs. Full stop. That's it. And we're going to have these links on our website because, you know, they're boring economic papers. But just read the abstract and you'll see what I mean.
And then probably Kai on his show will turn them into English. And
yes, we will. We will be doing that this afternoon. Mm-hmm. It's Tuesday. Oh, it's Monday, actually. So this, but you know what? By the time this drops, it'll be too late. But go back and listen to the Marketplace podcast after you listen to this podcast, and we'll tell you about it.
I know I put some other things in, but I took them out.
You lying liar.
Because wait, I changed,
did you switch it again? Oh, my God.
I did.
Seriously?
I did. I totally did. I'm just...
just and there's not even a link. It's just, oh, changed my mind.
I'm basically like a spinning coin myself, all the states are happening at the same time. I have a thing. No, I was talking to my friend about a thing this weekend and realized this is a question that I have to ask Kai.
What?
And we were talking about the Lyft IPO.
Yes.
And the valuation and how they're going to value the shares and the fact that, you know, Lyft lost $900 million in 2018, which is
$1 billion,
which is what Uber lost in a quarter. So, like, I don't know what everybody's so mad about. But what we were talking about was what is that? Like, how do you set a share price? How is that valuation determined? Like, is it essentially a bet on the potential profitability of a company? And then how does that explain something like a Tesla, where the price to earnings ratio seems totally out of whack, or Stitch Fix, which is a totally profitable company, but whose, you know, share price is like fine.
Right. Well, so setting the valuation at an IPO and actually the price once the stock is on the market are two different things, right?
Okay.
And once Tesla and Stitch Fix are on the market, it's a combination of potential and debt load and profit margins and all of those standard accounting things. In the IPO process, it's totally a crapshoot. Well, let me rephrase that. It's mostly a crapshoot with some educated guesses in there by Wall Street analysts, right? So companies will go around and they will do a roadshow and they'll say, listen, here, investment bank number one, this is what we're thinking. Here are our financials and here's our expected profits and here's our growth potential and all of this stuff. And they'll go around and they do these things and they'll select an underwriter, a company that will help underwrite the IPO on Wall Street, buy initial shares and all of that stuff. And the underwriter and the company and some other smaller financial consulting kinds of people will get together and figure out what they think the price at the open should be. And that's their best guess at maximizing returns, but also to some lesser degree, availability and affordability of the stock, right? Because if a stock is too expensive, it's not really tradable so much. But what happens is, and you saw this, it might have been Facebook, I forget. The Facebook IPO was a whole big mess. But the problem is you set the price the night before and then it opens plus or minus at that price. And then if it pops, right? If you set the IPO price at $10 and it goes to $25 right away, then people all come in and say, oh man, they left so much money on the table, right? Because the initial price is $10 and you could add it for that, but and now you got to pay $25 and it's a whole different thing. Or if it falls, you're like, oh, they just got too greedy, man. Should have been $5, you know?
Right.
So there's some weird kind of alchemy there.
And then that price, in addition to all of that weird alchemy and trying to get it right, still ultimately is not related to how much the company makes or might make? I mean, I guess it kind of is, but in the case of Lyft.
The actual initial price is everybody's best guess. Usually it's a hair conservative because you don't want the price to fall, right? You'd really rather give up a little bit on the upside than have money come off on the downside, right? But at the get-go, it's very much a guess. And then as the company matures and the stock trades and investors get used to it, then you get a much more sensible, most of the time, reaction to the company's actual value.
And sometimes people just get very excited about a company.
Yeah.
So then how does that relate to, like, I always thought that valuations for private companies were set as a like in relation to the potential profit or revenue of that company. But I guess if the company loses like $1 billion a quarter, but is still valued at 50 billion, what does that even mean?
Yeah, but let's look at not Uber, because they're so big now, right? But let's look at a company that in the VC process, and I know you've talked about this a lot on tech, right? About VC, but in the VC process, every round they go through, that by definition sets a value for the company. So if you buy 50% of my company for $50 million, that is a valuation of the company at $100 million. Right. And every time the company goes through a round, whether it's seed or A, B, C, whatever, that valuation gets refined until finally it comes to market and the market says, oh, no, no, it's this.
Got it. Okay.
And so Google is.
And
now,
that was the part I was missing, is like there's this private valuation and then there's the stock price.
Right.
And those don't seem to.
No.
Match up, and one of them is really based on a lot of debt.
Right. The private valuation thing goes away as soon as you start thinking about IPO and people actually start talking tangible money from other investors, from the market, as it were.
I see.
Yeah.
Once it goes from funny to real.
Yeah. That's
the conversation funny starts to change.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
There we go. All right.
Appreciate it.
All right.
My friends are so lucky that I have a direct line to Kai.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
Oh, hello.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
Somebody gave me a hard time on Twitter last week for commenting on the fact that I love that last little thing so much. And all I'm going to say is...
Why? They think you're picking favorites?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe. I don't know. So I'm not saying it. All right. So this goes back to a Make Me Smart question from, I don't know, like a couple of weeks ago. One of our listeners, his name is, said he had mixed up the list. So one of our listeners said he had mixed up the lyrics to the Toto song, Africa, Hum It Quietly to Yourself. Last week, Gil Cabrera wrote and said there's a term for when you mishear the lyrics of something. It's called a mondegreen. And here's Soraya Omar, also a listener. She sent us this voice memo. I'm going to let you play it.
Hi, Kai and Molly. I was excited to hear that somebody had written in about the word mondegreen, but they missed the coolest thing about it, which is that it is itself a mondegreen. It comes from the ballad, The Bonnie Earl of Murray, where the line, laid him on the green, was mistaken to be Lady Mondegreen. Love the show.
What?
Lady Mondegreen. Oh my God, you can totally hear it, right?
Lady Mondegreen.
You can totally hear that. That's awesome. Amazing. I love that, Lady Mondegreen. I love that.
That's amazing. Awesome.
There you go.
And there was an entire New York Times magazine story about it from 2012 that you will be able to find on our website. And
that
is so, I love how this just keeps on giving. The gift just keeps on giving. Hey, this may surprise you. There were some strong opinions about last week's conversation about socialism.
Oh my.
I know. Gabriel Chatelain wrote and said that that Senator Sanders, not Sam, our guest, but Senator Bernie Sanders, should address the darker sides of socialism. He wrote, it's his and his constituents' refusal to condemn the awful and authoritarian side of socialism that makes me sad/worried.
Well, we should be clear here, right? This was, I'm almost certain, and Gabriel, you can write in and tell me if I'm wrong, but it's a reaction to what Senator Sanders had to say about President Maduro down in Venezuela, who is a socialist. Bernie refused to condemn him as a dictator, which, you know, quite possibly was a misstep for the good senator from Vermont. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm gonna say it might have been.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Eric Sainio sent us a voice memo talking about the benefits of socialist policy without really knowing it.
There are a number of states in this great nation of ours that have significantly more that they receive in terms of federal tax benefits than what they pay in federal taxes, predominantly among them the majority of red Republican states, many of whom are very anti-socialist, which is to say they're benefiting from those exact same social policies that they themselves oftentimes condemn in a measure to be able to continue to benefit their own private citizens.
Well, yeah, I mean, Sam talked about this a little bit, right? He talked about some of the benefits of a socialized economy, which we enjoy in this country, which, you know, are not purely in accordance with capitalistic norms, shall we say. But yeah.
Right. And some parts are and some parts aren't. What's interesting is actually Kai pointed out a tweet today referencing a new NBC and Wall Street Journal poll. And that found that by a 50% to 18%, Americans view capitalism positively and socialism negatively. So 50% are for capitalism, 18% are for socialism. But by 55% to 41%, they want government to do more for their problems. And I think that's where you're seeing this idea that millennials might be pro-socialism. They're probably not pro-Maduro style government. Like, I think that's, and we were talking about how this is the like the line that Democrats are going to have to walk, and how they're going to have to explain constantly that they don't mean Maduro, but they do mean Medicare.
Right.
And that it's going to be tricky. But I think that gets to the point of like Trump populism even, which is everybody is feeling like no help is coming.
Yeah. I don't know about that. Here's what I think it means. I think it's a classic make up your mind America, right? 55 to 41, Americans want government to do more for their problems. How you feeling about your taxes, America? Want to pay more taxes so the government can do more?
Well,
write in and let
other
me know.
People
make me smart at marketplace.org. Send us a voice memo.
Yeah. Doesn't that simplify the tax debate? Like, is it really going to come down to individuals, or does it come down to the corporate tax rate and the millionaires and the billionaires and all that?
Yes, totally. Yes, totally. But you want to know why Republicans in Congress voted so heavily for a tax cut for corporations? Because their constituents wanted a tax cut as well, right?
Yeah.
You know.
But then they didn't get it. That's
all
the corporations did.
I have to
did.
Do my taxes, by the way. Oh, you're not done.
Me too.
You're not done.
No, I'm going to do them this weekend. Maybe we can just cry about it on Monday show or the following
Thanks,
show.
Whatever we're doing.
I'm going to put that in my calendar. March 12th, cry about taxes on Make Me Smart.
Oh,
sounds
God.
Great.
All right.
Time for our answer, this week's answer to the Make Me Smart question. And we can only hope that it will give as much as the Toto and Africa answer did. The question, of course, is what is something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about? Listener Emily Schumacher-Novak sent us this message.
One thing that I thought I knew, but it later turned out I was wrong about, is that I thought my husband had terrible taste in podcasts. You see, I was always the one who knew things about public media, NPR, whatever the great new show was. And he told me to listen to Make Me Smart. And after a year of completely ignoring his request, I have finally been evangelized to the Make Me Smart world. And it's great. Thanks for the show. And oh yeah, I was wrong.
Emily, where have you been? Where you been?
He made you say that. That's a shameless suck up by both the producers and Emily, and it's working.
One does wonder what the producers think they're going to get.
Well played, everyone. Well played.
I am just saying. All right, one more time on that question. What is something you thought you knew, but you found out later you were wrong about? Make me smart at marketplace.org. Send us a voicemail.
I'm going to start early because we got a lot to say.
We have a lot to say, so go ahead.
Make Me Smart is produced by Sharon Morris. Our senior producer is Eve Cho. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. This week's program was engineered by Drew Jostedt. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez.
The executive director of On Demand is Tar Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. And here's the part where I say nobody ever listens to the end of this thing, because those two certainly don't. And because if they did, number one, I'd have been fired. But two, we'd have heard about it by now. And it turned out that people actually do listen to the end of the podcast.
Oh, dude. And so welcome, everyone, to the official end of the pod club. Hashtag listen all the way to the end. We got so many tweets from you during last week's show. Someone introduced himself to me the other night and said, hi, I'm blah, blah, blah. And I listen all the way to the end of the show. Boom. Now we can just keep going because it's the end of the show and they're still listening. Anyway, so we got our one shout out, Karen Garcia. She said she listens to the end. She hopes our executive director and our vice president listen to it too. Deb, Satara, hello. Hello.
We're out.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.